The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Now, the first question was this one. Did God not create in man, or in some men, a possibility of same-sex attraction? Did God not create in men the possibility of same-sex attraction? Well, you could say yes. Sexual attraction is an odd thing. One in three men who identify themselves as gay are actually bisexual. That is, they find women attractive as well. But they choose to ignore that part of their attraction and go for a number of reasons. For what's two in three men, 15 out of 16 women who identify and live the lesbian lifestyle actually identify themselves under scientific studies as bisexual. That is, that their attraction is to both. The question is, where does that come from? I have no idea. There's what we know about, what we can say about the biology of same-sex attraction is, we know as yet it is not genetic. Although I read the article, as you probably did too, in the 1990s on the front page of the Herald, announcing the discovery of, the heading was, gay, it's all in your genes. Even if you read to the end of the article, the evidence from that particular bit of research wasn't saying that. But it's been publicised, we all know it, we know it to be true, but the science is crystal clear. My eyes are brown because of my genes. My heterosexuality, or if I was gay, my attraction was the same to men. I cannot make any claim to it being genetic. In fact, you can pretty much prove that it isn't. And the way you do that, because we may yet discover on the human genome, our gene, there it is. It's unlikely because they've been looking desperately for it. A guy called Michael Bailey has been involved in a number of studies, which are the key studies that you can do, which is the study of identical twins. He did a study in 1991, he did a restudy in 2000. The 1991 one, he has commented, is regularly quoted even now. His 2001 is almost entirely ignored. His study in 1991, he discovered that if I had an identical twin and I was gay, you would have a 45% chance that my identical twin would be gay. Right? Which proves it is not genetic, doesn't it? Because if it was genetic, if I was gay, he would be gay. If I have brown eyes, he would have brown eyes. But then his study was seriously critiqued because he got his people by advertising in gay magazines in Chicago. So people came forward. So people said, well, obviously they're more likely to be gay twins who are both operating out of the same lifestyle. So he did another study based in Australia, much bigger, based on the birth registries, where he went and found as many of these twins, where he found basically if you did there was a 25% link, so the numbers have gone down. So if I'm gay, there is a 25% chance that my identical twin will be gay, which again proves what? It proves it is not genetic, because if it was genetic it would be 100% correlation, people say, but the other 75% they're just repressing it. It's very interesting how we argue, isn't it? So when I talk to friends and family members about men I know who were in the gay lifestyle for many years and who now say, I've got some friends who are just celibate, who's just saying that's it, like lots of my heterosexual friends who aren't married are celibate. Some, it's more difficult than for others. I've got gay friends who are celibate. But when I talk to my friends about at least my two gay friends I know, and one I've heard interviewed from overseas, who lived in the gay lifestyle for a while, chose to be celibate. One of the guys got help hoping he might get rid of his same-sex attraction, and has, or seems to. We've had him speak at one of our events some years ago. And another guy who decided to be celibate, had been in the gay lifestyle for 20 years, realised he was never going to find Mr. Right, so he moved out, he became a Christian, he was getting help in his relationship with his father, and to his shock, he found himself one Saturday afternoon having a bit of a sexual fantasy that involved a woman. He said it was as shocking to him as it would be for most heterosexual men if they suddenly found themselves having a fantasy about being with a man. When I tell my friends of this, they know that's not true. They know he's lying. He's involved in some psychological trick. Why do we know this? We don't know it. But there's something about our culture that has taught us very deeply that this is an innate thing which is unchangeable. So I'm not sure if I would say God has made it any more than a young boy I know, the only boy who died when I was at Shaw in the school, had a few old boys died of cystic fibrosis. Now that is genetic. Do we then say, well, it's genetic, therefore it's good? That something is genetic tells you it's very hard to change, if not impossible. But it doesn't have any moral, therefore it's okay. It just tells us the source of it. But there's absolutely no evidence in that area. Would anyone like to ask further questions about that question of the origins of homosexual attraction? I've basically said what it isn't. But there are things seem to predispose people to be homosexual. There are a number of medical things that studies have shown gay men have more of. I'll give you an example. Gay men rarely have type A blood. I don't know what that means, but it's just true. A gay man will very rarely have type A blood. They're frequently left-handed. Up until the last 10 years ago, they used to often say that they're almost always not the older... They're almost always people who've got older brothers. But that's now been discovered that particular study was as dodgy as Bailey's first study on twins. And they have a higher incidence of rhesus negative blood. Now, there seem to be things that may predispose someone to be homosexual. As there are things that predispose some people to be addicted, as there are combinations of things that seem to predispose people to overeat, to watch more television, but to predispose is not to predetermine. That's a critical difference. If it's genetic, it's pretty much predetermined what you're going to be, but it's not genetic. Any questions on that area before I move on? Yeah.
At what point does somebody's upbringing
Okay, the question was, at what point is people's upbringing, I guess it's the nurture question, how much is it, if I find myself, is it nurture? The big argument which most gay activists have given up on, although they don't need to argue because now our culture argues it, even talkback radio hosts will say, we know it's in the genes, well we don't, but it's the stories out there for whatever it's worth. Most gay activists know a lot that I've talked to and read don't. They're not interested in where it comes from. They've given that argument of not. They're not arguing that anymore. If you have, say, the identical twins, the 25%. If I was gay, the chances of my brothers being gay is much lower than if I was an identical twin and I was gay. So there's a higher concordance, I think is the word they use, between one and the other, they're twins, which means what? There's some predisposition, but also the trouble is it's also nurture. You're being brought up in the same household. I personally have found persuasive the work of an English psychiatrist called Mowbray, and she has argued that for male homosexuality in particular, she's not quite as clear on lesbianism, the overwhelming pattern is a particular sort of breakdown between the father and the son. And it's nothing to do with the mother, between the father and the son at a crucial young age, about 4, 5, 6, 7. She's not saying, and that it's a certain sort of relationship, and that the child responds in a particular way and shuts down, and is yearning for this relationship with the dad. Now, what it doesn't mean is if you have a son, whatever, who's homosexual, it's your fault. Because she talked about it, it's a particular series of bounces between a type. She said, there have been some young men for whom their father's sickness is that key thing, where they couldn't read, they just suddenly lost the intimacy of their father. It's one of the reasons, some suggest, why it's so prevalent in cultures that send young boys off to boarding school. Because the son is likely to read that as some sort of rejection. Now, thousands of kids go through that who don't find themselves in, say, same-sex attraction. But it's a particular response to that particular set of events. So when that gets dealt with, so this is what happened to this this friend of mine I used to get to come and speak at the church I was at, when he dealt with the issues, with his father issues, he found himself moving on to finding women attractive, which I think it's fair to say, as the Bible does, that is the natural position. The Bible dares to use this talk of natural and unnatural sex. And one of the odd things about our culture is we're so blunt and brazen. But if you talk to people about the use of the body, people get all yucky if you talk about that. Let's talk about the fundamental sort of homosexual sexual act and the uses it does of various parts of the body. And I've had some of my friends who are really gay activists say, we don't want to talk about that. Why not? Because it does take you into the area of what is the body made for? And one of the sadnesses for my homosexual male friends is they really want to be dads. And you think a lot of them would be great dads, but that sort of sex is barren. Nature or God has made homosexual sex, it's barren. It doesn't have the possibility. Now, we can trick it now. We can do all sorts of things. But I think it'll be a funny blend between predispositions and nature. I'm being too long-winded, I'm sorry. What is the significance in John 8 of Jesus writing on the ground? We don't know. It's one of those annoying things the gospel does, that eyewitnesses do. They simply tell us that Jesus wrote on the ground. By the way, lots of people have made up significance, but I don't see how we can know we're not told. It does mean he wasn't an illiterate peasant. Why did the scribes and Pharisees bring the woman adultery to Jesus? Was this an acknowledgement of Jesus' authority or to trap him into saying yes? The reason they brought him, we're told quite clearly in the text, was in order to test, to trap him and test him. It was to put him between a rock and a hard place. Does he support Moses, or does he support the sinner who needs grace? Because the distinctive about Jesus was the offer of grace to the completely revolting in that culture sense. They were trying to get him between his obvious preference to be particularly kind and gracious to grotty people like me and the law of Moses. And he brilliantly, I mean, you've got to say something about Jesus. The guy's a flipping genius, even if you don't think he's the Son of God. To have no warning, if he couldn't get together with his clever mates and ring in a few geniuses and get their help, he has a split second to either oppose Moses or to protect this woman. I don't think the guys have any interest in Jesus' opinion. They had a court for these things anyhow. They could go to even Matthew 19:1-6. Can a man ever divorce and remarry? What Jesus says in Matthew's gospel in a number of places is, except for the grounds of marital unfaithfulness, that marriage is what God has joined together, let no man separate. The only grounds Jesus gives is marital unfaithfulness, sexual immorality. And if that happens, the marriage can be annulled, according to Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 7, to that is added desertion. If one person simply leaves, you don't have to pray that the person commits adultery. But if a person walks out of the marriage, either physically or sexually, a person is free to sadly divorce. And what in our culture, we have three categories, I think. We've probably got more than that. Married, divorced, single. In the category that God works in, you've got two categories. Married and single. Marriage takes you from the single to the so the wedding takes you there. Divorce takes you there. So that if you are back in the single position because you've been deserted or whatever, or sexual immorality has been committed against you, and you don't feel you can reconcile. Because I would think, don't want to talk about me, but if you've got a couple who both know Jesus in some way, even if they don't, but particularly if they know Jesus, and one commits adultery. That's not beauty. I'm out of here. The call is obviously to be like God and to forgive and seek reconciliation. But if the other person will not seek reconciliation, it takes two to tango, it takes two to be married. So yes, the Bible does reluctantly say, because of our sinfulness, those things are possible. Now, have we got time for more questions, or that do better?
Probably do, unless, yeah, maybe someone can chat to you after.
Yeah, I'll hang around, you know, until 12:30 if you like.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.